This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today we're going to be doing something on Dreamland that I have wanted to do and hoped I could do for a long time. Telepathy is real. And today we're going to show you that is true in the most basic sense. An extraordinary person is with us who has done something remarkable in the world. She is a documentary filmmaker and just a filmmaker of the first order, Kai Dickens. She's best known for her documentaries that shift public policy and culture. She had gotten the Focus Award for Achievement in Directing and the Changemaker Award for Influencing Social Change. And boy, is she influencing social change right now in a good way in the Telepathy Tapes, one of the biggest podcasts now in the world in terms of listenership. So far, there are 10 episodes of that podcast. You can listen to it on Apple Podcasts. You can listen to it on Spotify and YouTube and many other places. And now I'm going to introduce you to Kai Dickens, and you're going to find out just why you should not miss the Telepathy Tapes. Hi, Kai.
Good morning. Hi, Whitley. How are you?
Well, it's so exciting to have you here. A friend of mine turned me on to the Telepathy Tapes about 2 months ago. And the second I heard the first 10 minutes, I realized how incredibly important this was. Because we live in we are broken. But here, you're right. This is about people who are also broken, but in a different way. And in this important way, they're not at all. Kai, can you tell us a little bit about the Telepathy Tapes?
Yes, yes. And I love what you just said. So the Telepathy Tapes looks into claims of widespread telepathy within non-speakers with autism. And, you know, a lot of these claims have been made 30, 40 years ago, once non-speakers first started to communicate via spelling, which back then it was through facilitated communication, and that's now merged and evolved into other forms of communication through pointing at a letter board or talking into an independent talker that don't involve touch, you know, so they're independently communicating. But the first, as soon as a lot of these individuals are communicating, there was murmurs of telepathy, and that has been observed by teachers. It's been observed in classrooms. It's been observed and experienced by parents. And then Dr. Diane Hennessy-Powell, a neuroscientist, started looking into it about, you know, 10, 15 years ago, doing her own tests and found them to be absolutely everyone is correct that these individuals can read the minds of parents, teachers, often the people they're closest to. And when tested in a setting between behind a partition, the children are usually 100% right, 97% right. I mean, the errors are because they're having a difficult time controlling their body, and they accidentally point to the wrong letter at some point and then correct themselves quite quickly.
Dr. Powell has had an extraordinary and difficult journey with this. Mm-hmm. She reminded me a lot of Dr. John Mack, who legitimized the close encounter experience, but also nearly lost his license and his practice and his tenure and everything. Tell us a little bit about Dr. Powell. How did she come to realize that spellers, that is to say, unvoiced people, mm-hmm. were telepathically communicating with their caregivers and loved ones and others. And how did she first notice this?
Yeah, you know, she was studying savant syndrome. And that's often, you know, like 10% of people with autism tend to be savants, but you can be a savant in other ways. You can often, through a head injury, you can become an accidental savant where you have no prior knowledge or training in music or art or language, yet all of a sudden you can do it. So she was looking into savant syndrome because that seemed to be a very interesting key to consciousness. And with some of the autistic savants, eventually there was enough people saying, you know, I'm not actually sure if my child has memorized every line in that book. I wonder if they're reading through my eyes, or I think that they might be able to understand my thoughts. And that is a little interesting of a claim, but she started to look into it and started to test folks for that and started to find that it was true. I mean, that she could validate it in a test. And then what was really interesting is she dug back into time a little bit and found that there was a man named Bernie Rimland, who about 30 years prior to Dr. Powell coming along had said, I think that ESP should be considered a savant skill because I'm seeing it in different, you know, levels of the autistic community. And so, you know, she wasn't really the first to acknowledge this. And as we talk about in the telepathy tapes as well, that there was Sir Rudolph Peters, who was a scientist who was knighted by Queen Elizabeth, in the 1950s came across a blind boy who was suddenly, you know, able to read an eye chart when his mother was looking at it. And the second she stopped looking at it, he couldn't do it anymore. And Sir Rudolph Peters, again, this a knighted scientist by Queen Elizabeth, did tests and found out this boy had, you know, a telepathic link with his mother. So Dr. Powell really is like the modern day warrior on this front, has been trying to draw attention to it and get, you know, university backed tests completed. But she's certainly not the first scientist to have discovered this, this very real phenomenon.
Are hoping to have her on Dreamland quite soon, so I'm hoping that she will come and be with us and talk with us as well. She has had quite a struggle, because there is a tremendous amount of resistance to anything like telepathy, anything that isn't already understood about us doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. That's sort of, it's like, before the Wright brothers flew, there were plenty of scientific papers floating around saying that heavier than air flight was impossible. Mm-hmm. Had they been scientists and said the opposite, they might have been thrown out of the scientific community.
Yeah.
Now, what happened to Dr. Powell when she in effect said flight is possible?
Yeah. Yeah, so she took a lot of the research that she'd done, and she released a book called The ESP Enigma. And the medical board in Oregon took away her license without reading it, just having the audacity to suggest that ESP is real and has some scientific backing. And then the California board, where she wasn't even practicing in the state of California, also took her license away, and that was traumatizing because you get fined, she had to go through psychological testing to prove her, you know, that she had a solid mind. And it was extremely debilitating, you know, traumatizing. And the real irony, of course, is that she gets her license back the second people read the book and realized it was sound science. It was well researched. It was peer reviewed. You know, she's a really legitimate researcher and scientist, and it's just unfortunate. And I think that intimidated her for a long time. And one of the best things coming out of this podcast, in addition to just people having their worldview shaken up and to have their paradigm reimagined, is that Dr. Diane, I think, will finally get the funding to do really incredible airtight university-backed tests.
That's wonderful, because this is so empowering.
Mm-hmm.
Because once we understand that it's real, then we can go on down the road from there. And mm-hmm. I wonder how many non-spellers, there's say people who aren't on the autistic spectrum and can speak like you and me, would be able to begin to use telepathy. Because I think I speak for lots of people. I've had moments of telepathy in my life. I think we all have.
Yes.
It's not non-existent in us. It's just not used.
Right. It's just we forgot who we are. And I think that that's what's so beautiful, right? Like even Mark Twain talked about, he coined it mental telegraphy at the time, because he would note that letters would pass in the mail and often sent the same day when someone might not have talked to each other or corresponded for 5, 10, you know, 2 years, whatever it was. And all of a sudden on the same day, they write a letter. And so he was always marveling at that, the way that we marvel at, I was just thinking about you when right when you called me. So I think we are all still connected in this way, but just language, technology has replaced the need to use this, this awareness, this sense that we all have. But, you know, for me, there was ontological shock going throughout the whole thing, but, finding and witnessing, you know, witnessing this telepathy firsthand over and over and over again was something. I mean, that was really life changing. But then when teachers and parents started kind of humbly, almost nervously at first, telling me, look, I can start to hear it back, or I can hear it back, or through my child or through my student, I can hear their voice in my head now when I leave school. They can come into me at any time, or they could utilize my neurology, my ears or my eyes if they need to. And the first few times I heard that, you know, I think the instinct is to kind of throw it out. Well, that can't be possible. Wow, that can't be possible. And then enough people start to tell me that, but then you start to witness it, or, you know, kind of test it on your own with these folks, and you find out that it's true. So I think the non-speakers have certainly helped others that are neurotypical learn to turn on this beautiful, intimate form of communication.
Beautiful, intimate. Those are wonderful words, and so true, because I think most of us who've had a little bit of this feel that sense of intimacy and community that it brings. It's quite extraordinary. It's not ugly, and it's not scary. It's perfectly beautiful. And speaking of beautiful things, folks, this is a very nasty segue into the first break. We'll be right back. My new book, The Fourth Mind, is on pre-sale on Amazon. You can order it right now. But why is it called The Fourth Mind? What is that? Let me explain. First, I go into detail about the bodies, brains, anatomy, genetics, and beliefs of our visitors. And as you will see, there is reason to believe that this is accurate. Then I show they have abilities like telepathy and levitation that we don't have. Or do we? In the second part of the book, I show how we did have those powers, but lost them during a huge catastrophe 12,000 years ago. Was it some kind of bizarre war? A natural catastrophe? Whatever it was, it nearly destroyed humankind and left us in a state of shock that we suffer from to this day. I call the powers we lost the fourth mind and show how we can make a serious start at getting them back. Get the fourth mind. It's step one on our way to the stars. Pre-order the Kindle on Amazon today. It'll arrive in your Kindle on January the 15th. Later, there'll be a paperback, a hardcover, and an audiobook read by me. We're talking to Kai Dickens, the telepathy tapes. You can listen to the telepathy tapes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and probably everywhere at this point. It is, I think you said in an email the other day, the ninth most listened to podcast in the world at this point somewhere.
I think now it's in the top five shows, and it's the number two as far as series go, which is just...
It's absolutely exploding in the world. There must be millions upon millions of people tuning in. I mean, tuning in, because all of these people are going to be like me. They're going to discover the same thing I did. And a lot of my friends who've listened to, I went to a big conference recently, the Soul Foundation conference, and I just talked it up everywhere. I said to everyone at the conference, listen, listen, listen. And now they are doing that, and it changes lives, folks. This is extraordinary, truly extraordinary. It will change your life. Now, let's go into a little bit. We're going to jump ahead. I have a lot of questions, and a lot of the questions are from friends, of course, because I was asking a lot of friends, and I asked them all, send me questions, and they did.
Great.
And tell us a little bit about the two key things that drive this community, which I think are kindness and truthfulness. Would that be accurate?
Well, I would say love as the baseline.
Love.
Love and unity, unifying this realization that we're all one. comes up over and over again. And even with the non-speakers and their families, in order for this gift to really show itself, I think there has to be this deep, you know, presence, being present with someone, not being all in your brain, thinking about this, like really being able to clear yourself out. And love, I think compassion and love are baseline to it working. And you know, with that in mind too, one of the beautiful things I've heard so many, non-speakers talk about is just how this form of communication is so much more pure. You know, one parent said, who's able to receive the telepathy back, she said, you know, if I say the word Thanksgiving, or you say that word Thanksgiving to me, it just means Thanksgiving. If I receive that message from my son, I get the smells, I get the football game in the background, I get the family, I get sleeping in my childhood bed again, I get the music, I get the conversation, I get the snow, I get the, all of it, the entire feeling of Thanksgiving. And so, you know, there's just a purity in this way of communicating, right? How many times have you dishonestly answered, how are you doing? And with telepathy, there's no sarcasm, there's no lies, there's no white lies. There's just a truth and a purity to it.
You have to wonder what's going to happen to the political world if this becomes more widespread.
I know.
I mean, because they all lie constantly.
Yeah.
That's what they do.
Well, and it's interesting because a few people have brought that up. Like, I don't want people in my thoughts. And my next question is, well, why? Work on that then.
Listen, I thought long and hard during my listening period of listening to the tapes. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about this? And the actual truth is, I've got lots of creepy thoughts. And you know what? I don't care whether or not people know it or not, because it just doesn't, I mean, everybody does. Yeah. Everybody has thoughts that they think, oh my God, I shouldn't ever think that.
Yeah.
But we all do. And we're all together in that respect. So, you know, we have to kind of relax into it, I think.
I think so too.
Now.
Yeah. And I think that's the call, right? Is like, we should be evolving more toward this, into this openness and this intimacy and this unity, this oneness. Instead of being afraid of like, I want to keep people out because me. I mean, that's the opposite of what we should be doing. I mean, this is about breaking the walls down to kind of evolve as a whole, you know, human race.
Yeah. My wife, who's a very, very wise person, maybe even, dare I say it, enlightened, I think she might have been toward the end of her life. I asked her once, what is enlightenment? And she said, enlightenment is what happens when there's nothing left of us but love.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. And I also asked her about compassion. And she looked at me, this strange expression on her face, and said, Whitley, each of us is all we have. And when you think of that, when you're with another person, even someone you don't like or you're having a fight with, you see them manifesting themselves and you think, they're all they have. It changes everything in your heart immediately.
Wow. What a beautiful, your wife sounds like, she sounds like an amazing person. A beautiful
woman. I was the luckiest man in the world to meet that girl. We met in an early form of a sort of computer dating thing back in 1969.
Wow.
And as soon as I walked into the place where she was working as a receptionist and realized that the girl at the reception desk was Anne, I thought, that's mine. Boy, I'm not letting this one go.
I love it.
And we were not apart together again for more than 2 weeks for the next 45 years.
Wow.
So, okay. Let's get back to it. Can the spellers, can there be, there's two-way communication. In other words, a speller can hear people, but can people then communicate back and forth in telepathy, non-spellers?
Yeah. So, you know, and for a lot of listeners who haven't heard the show, this is going to sound just completely out there. But that's why I really encourage people to start at the beginning, because we go through my process as a skeptic, seeing the telepathy, seeing that these wonderful individuals, the non-speakers, usually with severe autism, are able to read their parents' minds. Often they'll say they can see through their eyes, hear through their ears. And it sounds unbelievable. It sounds what, but it is repeated and it's true and it's been verified all over, not just in classrooms and therapist offices, but obviously in these homes. So with that in mind, quite often, especially with teachers for some reason, they are able to hear the telepathy back and start to have this two-way form of communication. And it also happens with some parents. There's definitely parents where it's happening. I think with teachers, there's less of that. There's so much ego and other stuff wrapped around our own kids, right? Like if you're at a playground and watching a bunch of kids, you might enjoy it. If it's your kid, you're like, oh, why are they running with that? And that's da-da-da. And why did they do that? And why did they take off your shoes? Like you just are obsessed with your own kid all the time. So I think that's why for teachers, it's easier to unlock this at times. And it's actually really wonderful because from every single teacher that I've met where it's happened and parents as well, they'll say when it first starts, you are always questioning it. This image, this idea, this thought, these words came into my mind. It can happen in different ways. Is that mine or is that theirs? And often there's one teacher who says she receives what she calls an astral envelope, where it'll be this huge download of information from the young man that she's telepathic with. And she said that first she would write to him and is this correct? And is this correct? And can you verify this? And she'd have to go verify it all. And then she would realize, okay, this is coming from him. And these are things I don't know about. And he's answering questions I don't know about. But there's always a long period of verification. And there's a woman, a mother who I recently talked to, and I believe she lives in Indiana, and she has started this process with her son who spells on a letter board. But she said now she's gotten to this really deep, beautiful, intimate place where she can start to hear him back through telepathy. And when it happens, she'll get him on the letter board. Did you just say, you know, you want to go have cheeseburgers right now and then have chocolate ice cream and go see Wicked or whatever? And he'll say, yes, you got all that right, but you didn't get the movie right. I wanted to watch Wizard of Oz instead, you know, something like that. So these parents will verify it a lot in the beginning to make sure, because I don't think any parent or teacher I've met wants to just believe this willy-nilly. Like, you want to communicate. You want to deeply understand and make sure it's real.
Of course, there's got to be a certain amount of static, that in the sense that the receiver of the message is liable to have expectations about what the person wants that get in the way of what they actually are saying.
Yeah.
It's happened then.
Yeah.
So, you know, that definitely would be an issue. Now, can spellers hear anybody? Like if a speller is out in the streets, and folks, for you who don't know what I mean by spellers, can you just briefly, I want to go back to the question, explain what a speller is. I think we better do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for that. Yeah. So spellers is kind of a catch-all term, right? So the individuals in this project that I've been spending a lot of time with have something called apraxia, where they often, their mind and body are disconnected. They are fully aware, absolutely competent, extremely intelligent, have their own personalities, ideas, wishes, just like you and I do. However, their body will not obey their mind. I mean, how frustrating. And it is so difficult that often your body will be betraying you. You want to go here, but you start walking away. And one of the often parts of apraxia and this type of, you know, what they'll call severe autism in many cases is the inability to speak. And the reason why is that's a fine motor skill. However, what people have learned is pointing to letters is a gross motor skill. So there have been multiple forms of this type of spelling, right? It started off as facilitated communication, which involved touch. It evolved to something called rapid prompting method, and then something called spelling to communicate. And, you know, now there's various different ways of pointing to a letter board or pointing to an iPad to communicate. But the catch-all term I use in the telepathy tapes is referring to these individuals as spellers.
Yes. And, of course, there has been a lot of controversy about spelling as well because of the fact that, at least in the early days, there was a definite problem with the way it was done with holding the hand because it could be that the person doing the hand holding was doing the spelling as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, there in the early days, there were some definite issues and some big, big cases that became very public around, you know, a speller, quote unquote, spelling something that wasn't true. And then the idea was like, oh, can we believe this form of communication? Is the communication partner pushing their hand? Well, these cases just took down all of facilitated communication, and it has never, ever recovered from that stigma. And that's why these other newer methods revolve. There's no touch. You cannot touch. You know, the whole kind of community has evolved beyond touch to make sure that these words are legitimate. But, you know, there is an unfortunate piece to that because so many of the individuals with non-speaking autism and apraxia can't feel their body. So many of the individuals I've worked with have said they don't know they have fingers, didn't know they had fingers, don't know where their hand is, don't know where their feet are. And so,
hard.
Yeah. And I think part of being outside of the body is why so many of these gifts have heightened, you know, because they're able to kind of live in this more, a different plane. But yeah. touching the arm, here's your wrist, here's your arm, can really help someone even in the beginning of spelling just to figure out how to get going. So even though people can be touched still, I don't think it's fair to throw it all out. I think a good communication partner won't be pushing, won't be touching, won't be influencing.
So now let's get back to this issue of can they hear anybody? In other words, if they walk out in the streets, are they being able to pick up anyone in the street, or are they just their immediate, the people who they usually are telepathic with?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's varied. And I can tell you that for sure. Just like, you know, we have different skill sets and who can sing and who can play basketball. I think, you know, the one for sure, if you're the people you are close with, the non-speakers have said, every single one I've met so far said they can hear. So parents, a teacher they're working with. And then some have said that they are completely open to all the thoughts all the time. And it is just so frustrating and confusing and hard and often trying to make sense of who's thinking what. And then many, many, many spellers have told me I can only go in if someone is having loving vibes or good energy or there's this positive loving connection with that person. And some have said I can only do it if I'm invited in. So it's not like one baseline easy answer. I think it depends on each person. And I think it depends on maturity too. Just like we mature, they mature, you know, and just like you might, if you are a 7-year-old with a brand new gift, like you're a really good singer, you might sing everywhere. And then you realize, oh, I should only sing when people are wanting me to sing. You know, I think there's a little bit of maturity that comes into this as well.
You know, I have often wondered whether or not babies were telepathic. Mm-hmm. And so that leads, and we can't know. I'm not going to ask you whether or not you think babies are telepathic. But what I would like to ask you is, what age does the ability first manifest? In other words, when do caregivers and parents first begin to notice this in the spellers?
Yeah, well, instantly. I mean, well, okay, so just two things, because I think to answer this question, I have to say that I'm not sure what's happening in this remarkable community is solely telepathy. I think it might be something bigger, because many of the things that they'll point to are beyond just sheer telepathy. And by that, like, I have met multiple non-speakers who say they have memories from the womb. Well, how is that possible? And they'll have memories from their baby shower, have memories from the first few months of life, and can vividly describe stuff once they start communicating that the parents will have to look up and be like, Aunt Sue wasn't there. There absolutely wasn't. Like, I know she wasn't. And then go look at the pictures and it's like, oh my gosh, Aunt Sue was there. She just had to leave early for, you know, whatever. So that's interesting, that they have these early memories. I was interviewing a young man for the 10th episode, which is going to come out on Sunday, December 23rd. And I said, how long have you had this gift? And he said, well, I've had it for 20 years. And, I think it's just part and parcel of the experience of needing deeply to connect because you cannot speak.
Kai mentioned briefly something in that response that's terribly important. It was something bigger beyond even telepathy. Now, we're going to take another break, and when we get back, we're going to talk about something bigger. We'll be right back. We're talking to Kai Dickens, the Telepathy Tapes. You can listen on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and many other places. I would suggest to all of you precisely the same thing that I have suggested to everyone I've seen ever since I first heard the first 5 minutes of the first tape. Listen to it all. Listen to everyone. You won't be able to stop when you start. And there's Kai begins each one with a lead in that ends with the phrase, here we do.
Mm-hmm.
We do listen to this reality which is emerging into the world right now. This is a new birth. It's a new birth of a new kind of mankind is what it is. And it will spread from here. And you're looking at the lady who decided for some unknown reason to take it out into the world. Bravo, Kai. Now, yes, so, that gets me to something bigger. And I want you to just riff here. Open it up.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I thought that when I first started looking at this and doing the telepathy test, I was like, oh, this is so cool. Like, I actually think we can validate and showcase that telepathy is happening and that these remarkable individuals have a heightened gift, just like how often deaf people or blind people might have other, you know, senses heightened. That's what I thought. And then what the most humbling, important experience of my life was getting deeply to know and love and care for so many of these families and teachers and feeling immersed in their lives, right? And as I think that trust began to form, one of the things that was pretty quickly conveyed is that the parents were saying, like, this isn't just telepathy. You have to understand this is the tip of the iceberg. There's like a bouquet, if you will, of spiritual gifts. And, you know, some of it, you know, of course, like seeing auras, you know, colors around people and plants and, you know, and hearing or understanding like colors and auras around crystals and things like that. Others were people saying they can see math everywhere. They can see spirits. They can communicate with a higher power. They travel somewhere and come back with information. And often they'll talk about traveling there with a different type of intelligence or an angel. You know, I mean, and when I was first, this was really, really new to me when people were explaining some of this stuff. And it happened over and over again, not just with, you know, with people who, families who are agnostic and atheist, and then that they started being like, what is going on? Because my child is talking about this. Families who are super evangelical Christian, who telepathy is something that could be seen as really evil, but then they've come to grips with like, wow, there's a lot going on here. It's an Orthodox Jewish sect in Israel where non-speakers with telepathy are really validated and seen and also believed to have these like deep connections to the beyond. And so, and then a lot of the gifts go beyond that. And I think it's stuff that like, I'm actually feel always nervous to talk about with people, just like I felt nervous to talk about telepathy a year ago, terrified to bring it up, you know, but I can only say what the non-speakers tell me. And many of them talk about the fact that they can bilocate, meaning have their consciousness be in two places at once. Or that they can, if they're feeling really angry, they can communicate into their speaker, their spelling thing without touching it. And, you know, I haven't put any of this in the show yet because I haven't yet to validate it. I'm just anecdotally telling you what I've heard. So these spiritual gifts are immense and enormous. And one of the things I've loved is when talking about proving it, like going into the lab and stuff, some of the non-speakers have said, you know, the most important of all spiritual gifts that everyone has is love. You know, it can cause you to jump into terrifying waters where you might die to save someone else, or people will all of a sudden have adrenaline to lift a car off of like their 2-year-old child, you know. Love is the ultimate spiritual gift, but why do we not feel called to go into a lab and test that? Like, you can try to test all these spiritual gifts, but instead just own them and love them and appreciate them and nourish them. And I think that's so wonderful because we know that these gifts have been part and parcel to tribes and ancestors, you know, whether they're the Vikings or Celtics or the, you know, Aborigines, like since the beginning of time. And
right.
Back then, it's just part and parcel of existence. Knowing that you can be clued in, that you can feel when someone's watching you, that you can communicate, that you can remote view and go find out where the buffalo is so that you can go hunt them, you know, effectively. These weren't things that you put into a lab to test. It was just part of who we are. And I love that about the non-speakers. They're just like, you guys can try to use your instruments to test this stuff, but you're missing the point. Like, this is who we are. Come evolve into it now. You know,
it's interesting that you say that because, in my new book, before I was aware of the telepathy tapes, telepathy became more and more important in the book for some reason. Mm. And I found myself looking into the deep past, and I found almost certain instances of worldwide telepathic things going on that are completely unrecognized at this point. And I speculate about them in the book. And that gets me to the question of just how widespread is this? And are we tapping into something or generating it in our heads and projecting it like radio? Or is it a matter of tapping into a field of consciousness that is all around us, that is part of us and that we are part of?
I would say it's the latter. It's that we're tapping into a field of consciousness that's all around us and that we're all part of. And I think that field of consciousness has all information about everything that's ever happened and will be. And I think they're tapping into this consciousness because, you know, what so many of the parents have said to me is like, look, this isn't just sheer telepathy, because, you know, the second mom I met, Manisha, and her son types independently into a spelling device or an iPad, like across the room, you know, and she would ask the crew, okay, write a word. Any of you write a word. So the crew would write a word and then she'd start thinking and he'd start spelling it, or she'd look at it and he'd start spelling it. And then she would ask me on the spot to cross it out and start spelling something different. And the second I crossed it out and started spelling something different, he would then start spelling something different as long as his mom was looking at it. And so it was just the most unbelievable thing, because she was looking at me like, see, do you see? This is not just telepathy. We are sharing a consciousness. And she said, sometimes I don't know if it's coming from me first or from him first, or if we're like our higher selves are meeting and then combining and we're grabbing it together. But I don't know a single parent or teacher out there that would say this is just sheer telepathy. This feels to be bigger.
Could he have shared it directly with you?
I didn't do many tests to see if they could see what I was thinking, because we had such limited time that I was like, I know they're telepathic with their mom or with their communication partner or whoever. But I will say that many of the parents have done this when they first started discovering it, that they would have the siblings, aunts, uncles, whoever, do telepathy tests, write down a word, put it in your pocket, whatever, and they'll tell you what you wrote. And so I think when you are intimately engaged with any of these families, you see it all the time, you know. One quick note on that too, like, and this will be a bonus episode. I was going to go in episode 10, but I've decided to withhold it. One of the individuals who listened to the first two episodes of the show was a friend of mine, and he wrote me immediately and was like, I'm going through a bunch of stuff. How can I help? And I said, don't help me. Go help non-speakers. Go work in a classroom with them. And so he did that, and he started volunteering, and he's gone to the Hill now like 3 or 4 times. But beyond that, he said that the second he sat down, one of the non-speakers proved like telepathy to him. You know, he was thinking like, what state am I in? And all of a sudden he started writing Illinois on the letter board across the table. So I think maybe if you intentionally try to throw your thought, like you're like, okay, you know, I think it's easier maybe to catch.
Or maybe it's also an inner willingness to share. In other words, you're not scared to share. Exactly. You're not hiding anything.
That's a big part of it.
Now, you mentioned the Hill for the first time. We've been moving toward the Hill all the whole show, folks. You don't yet know what the Hill is, but you're going to find out now. Tell us a little bit about the Hill, Kai.
Yeah. Okay. So I think the third and fourth family I met were down in Georgia. And it was very shocking in an interview when talking to a wonderful mother named Katie, and she has 5 kids, 1 non-speaking son. And she said, her son Houston said that all non-speakers have this gift. I'm always afraid of words like all and never, always, right? Like it's just, I don't know. But she's like, he says that every non-reliable, unreliable, and non-speaking individual has this gift. And she said, in fact, many of them communicate together this way. And Houston, her son, calls it the talk on the Hill. And I was like, whoa, what? Wait, hold on. And she's like, yes, this is a common thing that they can kind of tune into a channel and hang out that way. And I didn't know, again, what to think or make of this yet. Like the families are the most authentically honest, transparent real people I've met. They're not pulling my leg. I know that. So the question is just like, well, how is this possible? Then I met Houston's good friend, John Paul. And his mom was like, he's on the hill right now. Let's go look. Like he will go upstairs usually after school or sometimes on the weekends. He'll go up there for hours. He'll put 4 or 5 pillows on his head to try to block out all the stuff in the house so it doesn't distract him. And he'll laugh and he'll cry and he'll emote. He's got best friends that he's met on the hill. He's developed this deep relationship with a girlfriend on the hill. And I was like, wow. So when I left Atlanta, I didn't have a fully formed opinion of what this is or how it was possible. I just didn't know. And at this point, I couldn't throw out anything because everything I'd previously thrown out my life had just come roaring back to become true, right? So then, it, you know, and people kind of discover this with me in the course of the season. Like at some point, I meet a minister who's a minister in Arizona at kind of a mega church, and they've got one of the largest special needs, you know, ministries in Arizona. And I got in touch with this minister through Katie because he had said, oh my gosh, this telepathy, I'm seeing this in my kids at this church. And I get on the phone with the minister. I'd never talked to him before. And he's just kind of catching me up on some stuff. He had never listened to the telepathy tapes. I think 1 or 2 episodes were only out at the time anyway. So nothing about the hill. And he says, you know, and what's beautiful is I'm connecting some of my individuals from my church with individuals in churches in other states. And the other day, two of them were on Zoom spelling, and we were helping, you know, type what they were spelling into the chat. And they ended it, come, let's go hang out on the hill sometime. And he's like, do you know what this hill is? And I'm like, yes, in fact, I do. And then I met a teacher in Chicago. Again, had never met me. Telepathy tapes weren't out yet. She said, oh, you know, the children talk about going to some place called the hill. And on the hill, they can talk with other individuals who are non-speaking from all over the world. Some of them like to talk about bees and time travel or this or that. And they're talking with individuals from all over. And so I heard about it enough and enough and enough that now I have no doubt that the hill is a real communication channel where people can go that's safe, where they can hang out and be themselves. And form friendships.
Let's talk a little bit more about it. Why is it called that?
I don't know, but that's what Houston is the person who named it that. And I can even text him right now if we want to figure out where that came from. But he named it the talk on the hill.
If you get a chance.
I'm just going to hold on 1 second. I'm doing a quick podcast interview, and if you have a moment, Kama, can you please ask Houston why he coined the hill, the talk on the hill, period. All right, we'll find out. We'll get that answer.
Let me ask you that.
Houston has a remarkable story, and I think it's so important for listeners just to understand what the parents are going through. So I would, while we wait, just like to do that because – you know, for instance, Katie, she was in a really, really tricky marriage with an abusive husband, has 5 kids, one with non-speaking severe autism, who is Houston. Katie leaves her husband, then is a single mom of 5 children, working 2 or 3 jobs. One of these children, Houston, has severe autism. She talks about how it was so severe that he would bite his hands down to the bone or muscle, constant blood. She said that he was always smearing feces on the walls. He had to sleep basically on top of him or always be locking him down because he would run off in the middle of the night, run out the doors. They had locks on all the refrigerators, all the doors, everything just to try to keep him safe and keep him inside. And she said it was a really lonely life growing up because she's like anywhere we went, the movies, we went to the dinner, people seem frustrated and annoyed that your kid is making noises or they're scaring the other children. And he felt like he couldn't control his body. So she had never thought, well, she always thought, well, he can't, I've seen spelling to communicate. He can't do it because he's too far beyond. There's no way he can control his body. Well, a miracle happened when Houston was 18. Katie had come home, I think the day before Thanksgiving, was shaking from working so many jobs, was so tired and wanted to give up. I mean, she was done. This was hard. He sits next to her, puts his hand on her and said, Mama, I love you. She'd never heard him talk. Let alone say mama, let alone say I love you.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Incredible.
And so
story.
It's beautiful. And he like pulled that was a miracle that he talked and said, mama, I love you. And so then she's like, I'm going to get you out of there. You're in there. I know you're in there. She figures she gets him into a spelling to communicate or rapid property, one of the spelling methods to learn to spell. And it takes a long time. At first, you're closed on the words, meaning you often will like point to yes, point to no. What are you looking at? C-A-R. Getting open on the boards is when you start to flow and just communicate and you're finally talking. And when Houston started spelling and communicating, so much of his body became centered and in control. Can you imagine for the first time in your life being able to say, I need Doc Martens because I don't know where my feet are, but having heavy boots would help. And he was able to tell his mom, I see quadruple, not double vision, not triple. I see quadruple. That would really help if you could get my eyes fixed. So he was able to start diagnosing himself, you know, and through that diagnosis, through the regimen, like that he gave her, like, I need to work out. I need to do this. I like crystals. I like stones. I mean, he started telling her all about himself, and that he loves American history, and he became much more, I'd say, you know, just, in control of his body, much more regulated. And, you know, when I was in Atlanta one night, we went out and had a beer at a bar and Houston's sitting there and just spelling away. And it's remarkable to see what a really self-possessed individual he's become. And I think having his gifts be known and validated as well as the access to communicating has made all the difference. And, you know, some of these non-speakers have see their roles in the world being very different, but Houston, I mean, I know that he says he's a teacher on the Hill. So he's important there. They haven't written back yet, but I'll keep checking.
Okay. You know, I am not alone in having tried to go to the Hill. And I'm also not going to get into too much about my personal stuff, except to say it was somewhat successful twice. There was someone there, and I think it might have been Houston, now that you say he was a teacher, who was really laughing at me.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you've ever tried to go to the Hill.
No, I haven't. I have not. But I'm going to do a bonus episode in January about this friend of mine, Dan, who has gotten there. And he's the individual that I asked or suggested to go work with some non-speakers. And what you said, Whitley, just now is really interesting because Dan said that when he went there, and why Dan was able to go so effortlessly, I think is really important. I mean, he faced death. He was just diagnosed with awful disease. He was diagnosed with stage 4 leukemia, I believe. And he had cancer all of his body. I mean, he should not be alive. And he's learned to control his thoughts. And Dan also talks about how he's been othered his whole life. He was like, I was a queer Jewish boy in rural Iowa. There was no one that looked like me. No one that believed what I believed. No one that had any. And he's like, so I've lived my life being othered and ostracized and harmed. And then I faced death. And when he started working with these individuals, you know, I think he was at a great place to go. But one of the things he said is that when he first arrived, first he wanted to do a test and start telling certain people from his classroom what he wanted to tell them to tell him the next day to prove that he actually made it there. But he said that there felt to be like teachers or divine beings of some sort kind of guarding the place. And he said they seemed to, keep it safe. And then I asked Dan, I said, did you hear all sorts of voices? Like, how do you make out who's who? And he's like, I am a newbie in this space. They would come to me. And one at a time would come to me. So I thought that was quite interesting.
It's interesting, too, that you mentioned that somebody's guarding it. Because the second time I went there, there was the most gentle presence that wasn't going to say to me, go away. Mm-mm. But I felt not like I was intruding, but that going there is something extremely special, and that you don't necessarily just get to go striding in there willy-nilly.
No.
Out of curiosity. And you know, this thought was, you've got to bring something. What are you bringing? And I thought, well, okay, I'm going to bring this show. This is what I'm bringing to the Hill and to every single person in the community, because I'm trying my best to spread the word and to open the door so that we all realize we have this inherently inside us. Every one of us does. It's just asleep, and it doesn't need to be. No. Not any human being. Okay, now, so the hill is a wonderful anchor in the imagination and in the mind.
Mm-hmm.
That phrase, the hill, is so, it has such a sense of wonder and mystery about it when you consider that it's a hill in another kind of inner space. It's part of a geography that we have just begun to explore.
Yeah. 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 And what I love is, I mean, and I'm still waiting for Houston to tell me why he calls it the talk on the hill, but, you know, I think it might have even just been a playful phrase, you know? I mean,
yeah, there's playfulness. It's fun. This is not to be forgotten. It's fun, serious fun.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think that's the thing too, is for people to remember, especially when presuming competence, as the non-speakers are all individuals with their own personalities. Like Amelia, who's 10, and her mom was trying to help me cut out a lot of the meat of episode 10 because I was like, oh, this is so hard and I don't want to hurt any non-speakers who are putting their words in. Anyway, Amelia was at her dad's and she came home the next day and of course telepathically knew what was going on and wrote the second she walked in, Mom, did you get a lot of the huge fat out of that big episode? You know, something really funny with like, and, you know, and just being silly. So it's like, that's the thing is, you know, it's not like the non-speakers are oracles. They are in touch with these gifts. It's a part of who they are, but they're also 10-year-olds and 14-year-olds and 8-year-olds and 25-year-olds and have their own very culturally influenced personalities. And
right. We have to take another break.
Okay.
Folks, I realize I'm well past the break time, but I'm not surprised. We'll be right back. We're talking to Kai Dickens, the creator of one of the most extraordinary and important podcasts in the world at any time, because it opens us up to the idea that telepathy is real. And that means all of us have a potential here. Now, of course, everyone listening is thinking, can I do this? Can I do this? I want to go to the hill. I want to be part of this. I want to be part of this great blessing. And what do we say? Because this is not done before. I mean, you've shown, and Dr. Powell has proved that telepathy is real among the spellers. Mm-hmm. But they are impaired vocally. Their voices don't work. Mm-hmm. They can't speak. They're not as physically embedded as we are.
Yeah.
What do we do? Do you have any thoughts about that, Chai, to maybe get to the point where we can comfortably be telepathic with each other?
Yeah. Well, two things. I mean, one, you brought up going to the hill, and I feel really, really don't, I really don't want to, a lot of people trying to go there. I can't control what people do, but it's like those, that space, it's their space, you know?
Yeah,
but when I brought up, but when I brought up this to Dan and I was like, is this okay that you went there? And I went and talked to a bunch of the non-speakers that I have on a text thread and was just asking, hey, like, is this okay? Do you know if Dan went? Was it okay? And they wrote back, yes, it was okay, because he's a true ally and has, like, you know, the pureness of the heart and the intention, all of that shines through. Which I also love, because here's Dan, who's always felt othered. And it's like, no, but in the space that's not related to our bodies, none of that matters. You know, like, it's the intention of your heart, the intention of your, you know, the goodness that matters. So I thought that was beautiful. And then Dan sent me a text, which in his kind of fun way was like, Kai, it's not like Halliburton can come buy it off, right? Like, this is a holy, it feels holy. It feels protected.
Yeah.
It feels safe. There's no one on earth that can overtake it. And Lily, who's one of the non-speakers that comes into our show in episode 4 and again in episode 9, she told me, she's like, people have come in there or have tried to come in with negative thoughts or to harm us or harm it. And she's like, we can overpower with the goodness of our thoughts. Like we are in charge. And so that was this beauty, right? Like that you often think of, look at someone's body and make an assessment about their strength or their power. But here they have all the strength and the power that they need. And we can't imagine it, you know?
Yeah, that was the very much the message of my second visit was, yeah, fine, but you go out and do your job, fella. Mm-hmm. And I've thought to myself, one of the things, I've had plenty of exposure to the intelligence community. Anyone who is in this close encounter thing as deeply as I am is going to.
Yeah. Yes.
Now, that gets me to what I consider a possibility, which is that community is going to pick up on it. And I know the community's techniques very well. And what will happen is extremely charming people who you have no idea are engaged in that world at all will come and begin to try to insinuate themselves into the community, not as telepaths, but as caregivers, et cetera, and so forth, so that they can try to learn how to do this, to do things like listen in on the minds of foreign adversaries and stuff. And I think to myself, this is something beautiful and pure now. And could it be destroyed by people like that trying to abuse it? Because that would be abusing it, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that I have come to learn after realizing that these gifts are valid was that I can't emphasize enough that the baseline for all of this is unity and love, the fact that we are all one, that I have never met a non-speaker who would ever use their gifts for nefarious ways or for spying or for harm or for domination. And that may be the government's intention, but they're not going to get anywhere with someone who doesn't want to participate. They just won't. And I agree that maybe warm, kind people, I mean, people who are charming that who are not warm and kind could try to.
Exactly. Yeah.
And exploit them. And I have two thoughts on that. One is that they might change in the process. Trying to get to a place with a non-speaking individual who has apraxia and has a hard time controlling their body takes a lot of patience and love and commitment and time. And I think just being in that space with them will change you into a more loving, open, kind, grounded person. And maybe that person would stop wanting their to pursue that. Or I think the non-speaker will know exactly what's up and just will not engage. Or we'll give them deep lessons. Like my brother was writing me today and he's like, I really think that Dr. Powell has to prove this in the Faraday cage really quickly because you got to get the da 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 so people believe. And I was like, that is great. We're working on that. That's going to be in the feature film. However, if you bring this up to the non-speakers, they would say, love is your greatest spiritual gift. Why aren't you trying to prove love? Like instruments aren't needed to prove this stuff. Like you should tune your hearts differently. I mean, that would be, I think, the response from the people that I talk to.
I think that's a beautiful response, and I think that we have to bring what is best of us to this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a vast, complicated, and beautiful thing here. And when I say complicated, I mean there are a lot of individuals in it, and quite a few of them are very angelic beings, and. Mm-hmm. You know, let's go a little bit outside of the envelope now.
Whitley, before you ask that question, Katie just wrote back, and it perfectly segues into what you just asked me.
Oh, great. So why don't you respond?
I will. And she starts it, and then it gets, and then Houston jumps in with his words. So she starts off and on. Oh, no, this is all Houston. Okay. Off and on over the years, there was a conversation that was hopeful and doubtful that truth would ever be heard about us. The talk became the energy. The words became the power. So the power is whatever we talk and say to each other. Power becomes used as war. Talk becomes power. So I call it the talk on the hill. Which makes me wonder if Houston was listening to everything we were just talking about because the way.
I just wonder, I had to tell you right now. I think Houston is actually participating in this show.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. Because
and that stuff happens a lot and it's cool. It's beautiful. But the fact that he instantly started going into power and yeah, war and nefarious stuff.
Amazing.
Yeah.
How beautiful.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can feel his soul right now. I mean, it's just so close.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Houston is immense and beautiful, a herald of love. And, yeah, you know, I worry about nothing in the non-speaker's hands. So that's why, like, I worry about us voice users who have lost our way in many ways. But yeah, when it comes to the Hill, I think they're going to be able to protect it and themselves just fine.
I think that maybe the good is too strong here for the old ways to succeed. And maybe this is the time when there's a shift between the dark side being on top and something else lighter being on top. Mm-hmm. And then the light can be seen and it's shown out into the whole universe and takes mankind with it. And we change completely into something new. That's what I think this is the beginning of.
Yeah. Yeah. There's in episode 10, like I said, the non-speakers I'm ceding the floor to them so they can just kind of talk about what they want to learn. And so many individuals, and a lot of these individuals I haven't met, right? They're word spread, you know, get this information in. And so that was fascinating to see the overlap in folks who don't know each other, often from different countries. And one thing that was brought up over and over again is like, we're already the new human. Like, you need to evolve to be the new human. And I kept thinking, what does new human mean? But from one individual that I asked that question to, he wrote back, you know, by new human, I'm talking like, we have the gifts that you'll evolve into. Like, we already have them. So this is a gift of telepathy, the gift of being able to cast your consciousness out, to glean more information, things that feel almost like superhero abilities. What this young man, Anthony, was saying is, I have all that already, and you eventually can become a new human if you so choose. But for him, he said, this is how he ended it. But the way to evolve starts with kindness. Kindness and compassion is the quickest way to evolve.
Absolutely. That is so very, very key to everything. Mm-hmm. I think that we live in a world that is infected by an unkind spirit within us, a lot of us. And we have to just say to it, I'm tired of you. Go away. I can be kind. It doesn't have to be that I hate who doesn't believe as I do, who doesn't look as I do, who doesn't think as I do. I'm bigger than that. I just didn't know it.
Whitley, my cat has stuck between the window and the blind, and it's going to be very loud. So let me just go open the blind.
Let me put us on pause, folks, and hopefully everything will work fine and we'll get back.
Hold on one second.
Must be helped. Okay, we're back, and the cat is safe, and I is fine, and all is well. All right, so let's now talk about, I want to get into crystals, and I have some specific questions about specific spellers. And Houston, who I think is involved in this show, by the way, folks, I think Houston is maybe even to a degree guiding us because of what just happened. Is he the only one who relates to crystals and rocks? Because what episode is that in, Kai, the crystal about crystals?
That's in episode 3.
Episode 3. Well, that just bowled me over because I've always had a question in my mind. Is this stuff about crystals for real? I'm very attracted to them, and I don't know why.
Yeah.
Tell us more.
That was a big moment for me too, Whitley. And for the same reason, I always would be like, why do people buy these? And they're beautiful, but do they really have energy? Do they really affect this and can protect this and blah, blah, blah? You know, so I was very suspect about any of that. Not closed-minded, just not embracing it. And so, you know, this is episode 3, and Katie and Houston, we spend some time with them. And Katie has a story that is fascinating, which was that you know, Katie was at a massage once, and anything new agey, I think, really kind of freaks her out. I think she would say that too. And the massage therapist gave her a bunch of crystals and was like, bring these home and, you know, sleep with them. And Katie was like, oh, okay, lady, you know, kind of like respected her, but just took them and put them in the bathroom next to the tub or something. And Houston, when he came home from wherever he was that day, most likely school, he charged through the front door, charged through her bedroom door, and then charged through the bathroom door. So three doors and beelined for the crystal. And she was like, what is happening? And he was so excited. And he's mentally speaking. I believe he was saying stones, stones, stones. And he takes them and he races to his bedroom and he puts them all next to his bed. And he laid as close as he could, like on the pillow where the rocks were on the nightstand. And he said that they were letting off such good energy and he wanted more good energy like that in his house and that he could feel them. And Katie was like, okay, we're going to go get you more crystals. And she said not too long after that, actually, she had bought like crystal dice for her, you know, son-in-law who was, you know, Dungeons and Dragons guy or whatever, and had wrapped them and hid them and hid them away. And that Houston came home that day and knew that that there were new crystals and rocks in the house and went right to the package and found them. So it's remarkable because that validated another thing that I'd kind of tossed aside or threw out from my worldview as something that just is sweet and maybe nice to believe in, but not really true or effective. And now I'm have crystals in around my house. And yeah. And Houston's room is like a rock and gem show. I mean, he is beautiful and huge rocks and he loves to touch them and put them near his face and hold them. And he can feel different vibrations coming off of different rocks and crystals. So I want to do that in season two. Actually, my brother's a geologist and he has one of the most fascinating, gorgeous displays of crystals of anyone you've ever met, you know, really lovely specimens, as he would call them. And I thought how wonderful to bring Houston there to try to identify what all these are, maybe blindfolded or, you know, because he can feel them deeply.
That's because this is a whole level of relationship with the earth. And oddly enough, it gets back again to the book I'm just about to publish, a fourth mind. I mean, it's already published by the time this recording is out. And it seems to be kind of woven into this somehow because part of the book is about how we got cut off from our energetic relationship to the planet and why it happened.
Yeah.
A long time ago, more than 10,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And why it happened. And this is reconnection.
Yeah.
Reconnection in some way. He's leading us toward reconnection because he sees it in a way that can't be falsified in a sense.
Yeah.
In other words, it's not imagination. He runs right in. He doesn't even know. No one's told him they're even there. And he runs right in and he embraces them and brings them into his life.
Yeah.
It's like saying, I'm reconnecting with this earth that is my mother and my home.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, even while there, Katie does a really beautiful job, like making sure Houston will sit in the grass and like connect with the earth every single day. And that is something so many people don't do. I mean, I don't do that. I should just go sit in my yard every day and just like feel the earth beneath you. But the great lengths that she does to keep Houston connected to the earth in this world that makes it very hard not to be. Has really helped him again to have such beautiful composure over his body now in a way that he couldn't before.
That's so wonderful. This has got to be one of the most beautiful and life-enriching shows I've ever done. I'm feeling a tremendous amount of energy from just the conversation and the feeling that not just Houston, but there's others who are becoming aware of our conversation. We're not alone here.
No. And what's so sweet is, like I said, every single individual who I've met and featured in the show, I would say, has a different interpretation of the world and different gifts, if you will. But there's a little girl once who was saying, I can see, you know, auras around all sorts of things, around animals, around rocks, around individuals, around plants. And I said, well, what about cut flowers? And she said, they'll have an aura for a while and then it starts to fade. And it just made it so tied to life, like the life, But it was just interesting because I'm like, so if something has an aura, does that mean it has a consciousness? Like, what is creating an aura? I don't know. I mean, this is like a different expert has to come in around that type of stuff. And auras are things I didn't believe in either. I mean, I knew people talked about them, but I was really pretty straightforward, like journalist documentarian walking into this. You know, I was not that new agey. I mean, I had like friends that, and I was always open-minded, but I just didn't believe in, like, I don't know. I just shook off a lot of it. And then when so many non-speakers are saying you are blue and purple and they're all telling me the same colors all the time, I'm like, oh, okay, cool. I'm blue and purple. Woo. You know, and reading auras left and right around people. And it just made me wonder, okay, so is an aura have to do with consciousness? And then why would rocks have one and plants? And of course we know that plants are much more intelligent.
Yes.
Than we give them credit for.
You know, my wife didn't allow cut flowers in the house. Mm. And after she passed on, I love flowers and I was feeling quite lonely and I was wishing I could have flowers, but I didn't have flowers. And I had this psychic came over and it was after 5 minutes, he had been referred to me by friends. And, it was obvious that he definitely was in touch with him because he was talking about things that no one but me knew. Not my soul. And suddenly he said, Anne says you can have flowers, but you have to treat them right. Know that they are very much alive and they want to be there if you want them there and love them. The flowers behind me, and this is not unusual in this house, are now more than 2 weeks old. And look at them, folks. You can barely see them. Unfortunately, the camera is... But they are fresh as they can be in a dark room. There's no sunlight in here. And that's the case. At least I don't have to spend much money on the flowers because they last so long in here.
Yes.
You have to let yourself be.
Yes.
Open. And I'm actually part of the world. I'm not alone in this thing. This is my tool that I use to be in the world.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's beautiful. The whole thing is so beautiful. Now let me ask you this. John Paul comes off as incredibly powerful.
Yes.
Are the others, is there a gradation of telepathic, ability among the spellers?
Well, it's so fascinating because every telepathy test that we conducted, and again, like I just want to emphasize, this wasn't like at, you know, Harvard. This was like me and my film crew trying to put out everything we could think of to make sure that this was legit and to test the proof of concept, right? And so when we did that, every single time I was blown away. And we were thinking of everything. We were the ones doing the cues, downloading the number generators, keeping people far apart, looking at their eye lines. So they're all extremely telepathic. But here's what's interesting. You know, I think you're referring to the fact that he was, did hundreds of these with the neuroscientist, Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell. And then we also had another neuroscientist, Jeff Tarrant, there doing a QEG scan on him, on John Paul. But what was fascinating is that when we brought him over to the film area where we were going to film them, John Paul was having such a hard time controlling his body that we couldn't get him to do it. I mean, he was just so activated, I think, by all the people, mm-hmm. all the things happening that, you know, his mom Libby kept apologizing to me, like, I swore he did it this morning. You didn't see it all, but he did it this morning, left and left. And he just kept doing it. And so what I did in that room is I asked everyone to leave, just like, please, please. Like, 'cause I think everyone's thoughts were really impacting John Paul. And then he did it a few times and then, you know, he got really excited again. So I think that's what's an interesting thing around trying to test some of this is when it was really quiet with John Paul and just the neuroscientist and his mom and the film crew wasn't around them. He was just off the charts. And when we brought him into the testing setup, he just didn't want to do it. He kept getting up and he wanted to go over to the sink and grab water bottles. Like he was just, really.
It made him uneasy.
Yeah.
The setup made him uneasy. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's this I just keep thinking about this, like, beauty in this, that, like, anyone who works with the non-speakers, I think to some degree, will see their spiritual gifts. And I think that if you are willing and open to receive the telepathy, you will see it. No doubt. That's why I think the anecdotal evidence in the show of hundreds and hundreds of parents and teachers and siblings and nieces and nephews and grandparents and all the people who see this is so powerful. But it is funny that like you try to get individuals in the lab who are sensitive to lights and noises and new surroundings and new people and the thoughts of the people. It's gonna be harder to create a controlled test because of those elements that really need to be like thought about and cared for. And I just kind of love that because it's like, if you experience it, you believe it. And
yeah,
and
exactly.
It's like the skeptics who need the instruments and need the proof. And I mean, we'll give that to them, but the non-speakers, I think, would say you're missing the point. Like unify, love, be with us in kinship. Like we'll tell you, we'll help you, we'll teach you, we'll do anything, but also we kind of have to help them simulate in their bodies in our world that is not built for them, you know?
You know, in speaking of getting acceptance out in the, for example, the scientific community is just one example. This involves a lot of ontological shock. That is to say, the shock of the new to the people in those communities, because it challenges the basic paradigms by which they live.
Mm-hmm.
And there has to be a level of kindness and openness and acceptance and a sensitivity to the suffering mm-hmm. that is involved in having your paradigm changed, mm-hmm. especially for someone who has built their whole life and career around a certain set of beliefs. Mm-hmm. This goes for people in the spirit religious community who have ideas about demons, et cetera, and so forth. And it goes to people in the scientific community who have come to the certainty that the consciousness is strictly in here and that things like this are impossible.
Yeah.
We need to learn as we go along how to respect their needs in order to successfully do this. It's very important. Now, I want to go back to some of the other, Mia. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about Mia and mm-hmm. her past life experience, and then I'd like to ask you a few things about that. No, I can't hear you. There you go. You're back.
The worst technology is to put a button on the top of a mic where if you accidentally touch it, it mutes it. Okay. So Mia, yeah. So Mia was the first individual I met with these gifts. What I had found around the time that I had just entered this world, COVID was a gigantic shift in the discoveries of parents, because for the first time, you have to remember, most of the world thinks that non-speakers aren't in there. They're not competent. They're not capable of learning. They're taught like they're a 3-year-old, even if they're 14, 15. So COVID created this opportunity for parents to be forced to sit with their non-speaking child and try to teach them and figure out what they know. And unlike the school system, who often treated them pretty poorly, these parents were like, wait a second, my child is in there. Oh my gosh. They want to spell. Wow. They're pointing to a keyboard. Holy cow. You know, I mean, it was an explosion of awareness, I think, for parents, like a huge coming out for a lot of non-speakers around the world. Mia was one of them. She was 13. She was in Mexico during COVID. Her parents learned that she's very much in there. She was excited to spell, to communicate. She wants to be an author. She started keeping a journal. She's smart. She's brilliant. She's telepathic. And go on and on and on. In fact, the reason they figured out she was telepathic is that they would do huge numbers for her in a calculator to figure out what she knew. So they'd be like 5,796 times 1 million times, da da da. And then she'd boop, 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 type the answer. And they thought, she's a genius. She's a savant. She's a math savant. And then one time they did it and they forgot to hit the equal sign. And she sat there and was like, I don't know. And they're like, well, we'll tell the number. And she's like, I don't know. And then they said, well, how will you know? And she said, hit the equal sign. And they hit the equal sign and she could see it through their eyes.
So she could see that she was seeing. Wow.
Yeah. So that's when the parents were like, wait a second. Because also with Mia, when they were in this discovery thinking she was a savant, right? They thought she was just brilliant. What they did is at one point they were picking up books off the shelf. They'd open up to a page in a book and say, okay, Mia, tell us what's on page 512. They thought she memorized every book in the house, that she was this genius. And then Mia would start to spell what was on the page in the book. And then eventually they realized if they closed the book and said, Mia, what's on page 512, she would have no idea. So she had to be looking through their eyes, or the information had to be entering into her mother or her father, actually, because she could do it with her father at home. It's just she's not in the test lab that we created.
Now, her father had a journey to take to get to accept this, as I recall.
Well, I don't know if Mia's father did. Other fathers did, but not Mia's father. It was Amelia in episode 7. But so with the reincarnation, one of the things that she started saying in her journal is, and this really, again, this is like a very Catholic family in a kind of a smaller town in Mexico. First, they find out their daughter's telepathic. They actually took her to have an exorcism because I think so often these gifts, I don't know why, historically often are so tied to something negative, mediumship, telepathy, whatever it may be. But
people are afraid. Mm-hmm. They fear what they don't understand, and that's why they demonize it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's true in the close encounter experience. A lot of people demonize it because they're scared.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah, yeah, it's the fear. So in Mia's early journals, she was saying, she would talk a little bit about Carlos and then being a carpenter and a pastor. At first, we're like, oh, my goodness, she was Jesus, because she said she was a carpenter. And then she said, no, I lived in 1850, and I remember this. And then she explained that that's why at family parties, they never knew why she didn't like going to family parties, because she liked going to the mall. She liked going to the big swimming pool. So they knew she wasn't upset with being around people. And then when she was failing to communicate, she said, no, I don't like going to family parties because you guys make me wear a dress and fancy tights and have my hair down and wear earrings, and I don't like that. I like to feel more like Carlos. And her parents thought, wow, okay, this is really interesting. And Mia also said that she remembers that she had a brother in the womb, and her parents were very affected by this because there were two heartbeats in the beginning, and they lost one. But they never said that to Mia. That's not something often you talk to your child about. And Mia says, no, I knew. And it was a boy, and he was there, and I remember. And then he wasn't there. And so that's confounding. It's absolutely confounding. And when you hear these parents completely struck with utter confusion as to how their children could know this type of information, it's more than telepathy. It's just more.
Exactly. It's more than telepathy. That gets me to another question, and we're coming up on the end of our time together. We have about 10 minutes, perhaps, about diagnosing people. I know that there's, tell us a little bit of, can the spellers diagnose people? And if so, is there any possibility that this could be organized somehow?
Yeah. Well, that's the dream. And that's what I'm trying to work with. Maybe trying to start a big foundation, and we're trying to find some fundraising for that. And if the movie does well, any profits from the film could go to this foundation. And what this foundation would do, I'm hoping, is to connect non-speakers in the interested fields. You know, like Akil wants to work in plant medicine. You know, Amelia wants to work toward autism help and assistance, and you know, stuff like that. So there's different things, different non-speakers, just like us, are interested in. But putting them with the best and the brightest minds who are willing to meet them where they're at, willing to sit with them and learn to spell with them, what could come forth is absolutely astounding. And I think, yes, I know a few non-speakers who travel around as a brother-sister team doing energy healing and can heal quite remarkably. There are multiple families. Most, I haven't included any in this season yet, but it's going to be in season 2, who are unbelievable at assessing what is wrong in a human's body. They can look at you and say XYZ. There's been so many cases I've heard from parents that say, oh my goodness, when my son was 14, you know, their older cousin was in and he said, you're pregnant with a boy. And she turned bright red and like, there's no way. And like had no idea. And then 5 days later, she found out she was pregnant with a boy, stuff like that. And I've heard stories like that over and over and over again. So what are they tapping into? Is it knowing that a new soul is in that body? Like that's like one way to take it. Or is it like that they can sense the new, their DNA is whatever. I mean, like, I have no idea. And then of course there's been many, many cases of like seeing, knowing that there's a cancer in the body before someone knows for sure or what's going on within the mind. It's absolutely unbelievable. And I don't think there's a limit to what can happen here if we really meet the non-speakers where they're at, empower them, to assist us. But, you know, we have to assist them too, but like we have to assist each other.
Do you think that they chose to come here in this challenging and difficult form in order to give this gift to the world?
That's a hard question to answer for every single person, obviously. And I know that a lot of, you know, having this level of apraxia can be so frustrating for families, for the individuals as well, who deeply want to control what often they'll call their unruly body, you know. And it can be filled with pain and trauma and frustration. So I'm sure a lot of people would say I would never choose that, but I will also tell you that there are multiple non-speakers who I've talked to, who I've interviewed for this final episode, who said, I absolutely chose this. This was on purpose. We are here to help evolve humanity. We are here to help you. The work that we can do energetically, we can only do in these bodies. I'm not having as miserable experience as you think because I'm so engaged energetically, like on a different plane than you can even see or know. So it's a hard question to answer for everyone, and you can't speak for everyone, but there's certainly a lot of individuals who've told me that this was a choice. And it's a choice born out of love, for us, I think, for many of us.
Well, there's more than one angel involved in this, not just the spellers, but there's somebody else who has done something truly extraordinary, Kai. I'm looking at her. You bringing this to the world. And we are here in this time, in this very difficult era that is going to get more difficult and not less.
Yes.
To find freedom and to find our true humanity. Kai Dickens is bringing us a new chance. And I want to now, after we've finished, I want the last question to be, what in your heart drew you to this, to the spellers? Because something did. And I've looked on your website, and there's something about your heart in everything you do that's incredibly beautiful. And I have to ask you, are you an angel or not? And a mother and a wife and all that stuff. And also the
owner of a business. I was going to say, ask my kids if I'm an angel. I don't think I'm an angel, but I think I'm surrounded by them. That is for sure. And, you know, I'm a very sensitive person. That is true. And I deeply feel, for humanity. And it's really interesting to reflect back on this particular project, because I do think everything in my life has led me to this project. This is what I was here to do. And my mom has reminded me that when I was in high school, I started an inclusion program, you know, where you bring, children either with, or students, you know, with autism or with, cerebral palsy or MS or whatever people are going through into mainstream classrooms. So they're not in special ed classrooms. And I was passionate about inclusion in high school. And I remember my mom told me that I used to pray that I'd have a child with special needs because no one else wanted them. And I remember my mom being mad at me. She'd be like, why would you pray for that? That's such a difficult life. And I'd be like, no one else wants a child with special needs. Like, I would gladly take them. I hope I get all of them. And my mom would get mad at me for that, which I remember thinking she was like, how could you be mad at me for that? You know? And then, you know, my brother was diagnosed late. He is high functioning, very high. He's got, Asperger's. So, you know, he had a difficult time socially throughout life. I think he's had a very difficult time with emotions and, interpersonal relationships, but can function much differently, much better than not better, just more independently than the people in my show. So I think there are certain things like that have informed me. But what really happened was I've always worked on social issue films, you know, trying to make life better for a large group of people by informing them with important information. And then I had two really close friends die in the prime of their lives, you know, right around the COVID time. You know, one was someone that was working around the clock in Kansas to help anyone who was unhoused. He'd pull over on the side of the road. What do you need? You need medicine? Get my car. You're coming back to my house. Okay, we're going to shower. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. Like, he was unbelievable. And, you know, died in a car wreck. And then another friend who was a detective, unbelievable human being, super connected to things that I can't even be on, you know, and she committed suicide. And both of those deaths, like, really rocked me over to the point where I thought, all right, I don't know anymore if there's a meaning, if there's a purpose, if there's anything else that's out there, if any of this matters. Because if those two unbelievable individuals couldn't cut it here, didn't even get the chance to finish out their stay, what the F? I mean, that's kind of where I was at. And I remember saying, I'm praying. I said, you know, I don't want to, as a documentarian, often you work 3-4 years behind the scenes before you're ever paid, before, you know, at least I do. I'm doing all the research. I'm researching books, conversations, because if you're going to tell a story, you have to be immersed in it. You have to know it. For me, at least, I have to have my whole arms around it. So I thought, I'm going to do this. If I'm going to put another years of my life into something, I want it to be a quest to understand why we're here, where we're going, where we're come from, and if there's anything that can give us proof that we are more than our bodies, then that's what I want to spend the next part of my life working on. And I shouted that to the universe. I prayed it to God, to anyone listening. I will not work on anything else unless I'm trying to figure out why we're here. And this is what came out of it.
You got listened to, it looks like.
It really, that's how I feel. I feel like it was an answered prayer in a way, you know.
Folks, we're going to be talking to Dr. Powell soon, as soon as I can catch her and get her on the schedule, hopefully later in January, early February. Thank you for beginning my year and my next year of Dreamland and on this journey, because this is the next step. Everyone, listen to the telepathy tapes, open yourselves to it. Don't try to go running to the hill just to see if it's really there.
No.
You find your own way. Thank you. Thank you, Kai, for being with us. KaiDickens.com, the telepathy tapes.
Thank you, Whitley, so much.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.